Hello, this is Colin Meaney, and you're listening to Subspace Transmissions.
I want the truth for all of us.
Did my crew and I work together to save all sentient life in the universe?
Didn't you see all of us, imperfect and flawed as we all are, still live up to our best ideals? It is the greater good I am fighting for. Together you could create something bigger than yourselves. That's what the Federation is.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge.
Oh, this is Tyler Orton, just in a postcoital position talking about my sibling.
I actually made a note about the postcoital thing as well because I was like, have we seen this on Star Trek before?
Have we seen people talking about their brother after they've just had sex? Isn't that weird?
What, that's not common?
Well, good to know that you don't have a brother, Cam. But,
yeah. I'm only assuming the people that have brothers do this.
Well, I do that. I've got two brothers, so I talk about both of them at the same time.
That's amazing. But I was wondering, have we seen this before? Because a lot of like Star Trek is the kind of the classic of, you know, the sex happens off screen. We don't tend to see much. And I was like really like racking my brain. I'm sure there's examples. There has to be, right?
There has to be like situations in which the couple has one of those L-shaped blankets on, you know, where you see the man's chest and but it's up to the woman's collarbone. I don't know. There must have been like a Riker moment. I'm thinking about The Game where like he's chasing that woman around on Ryza with the headgear. And I don't know. That's got to be a post-coital moment, right?
Was there one in Angel One?
I don't think so. I don't think there was any actual sex on Angel One, despite the outfits. What you wear dictates, yeah, blah blah blah. You know what I'm saying.
Yeah, of course. The only other thing that popped to mind was Troy and Riker in Insurrection.
Oh, with a beard shaving. Oh no, that was an Insurrection. And then and also the Nemesis. Remember, we did see them in bed together, and we had yet another telepathic sexual assault scene take place via Shinzon.
Of course. Yeah. So I guess there have been examples. It's just not something that's very prominent on Star Trek. So it did jump out in a weird way, where in another franchise, I would not blink at all. It wouldn't seem at all strange.
So with all of that sex talk out of the way, Cam, what are we talking about this week?
We're going to talk about sexy unification part 3.
Interesting. Cam, can I track the journey of one Gabrielle Burnham?
You may.
I orphan my daughter when she's like 8 years old. I seem to be watching over her through an intermittent Red Angel spacesuit over the years. I briefly reunite with her while she's in her 30s. We hug, we cry. I know it's Star Trek Discovery. There's a lot of crime. And then I'm once again dispatched away for my daughter, and it's been at least a year. It's still very unclear how long Gabrielle has been in the future versus Burnham, because Burnham was there for at least a year before the Discovery arrived. So I'm apart from my daughter for an entire year after this brief reunion. But guess what? Some alien nuns take me in and heal me, and I tell my daughter, sorry, I gotta go hang out at the nunnery now. Wish you the best of luck.
That sounds about right.
Does this
make
sense? It's
a pretty insane journey. It's a very insane journey. When that character walked in with the shroud over the face, I'm like racking my brain, like, who is the reveal here? Because even though Gabrielle Burnham has been popping around my head the last while, because I've been waiting for the reveal of when this character was going to come back, honestly, when my sister had popped up on the podcast a couple weeks ago and said she thought she was going to be responsible for the burn, I was like, well, it kind of makes sense because this character is still dangling out there. But the fact that she was revealed here, I was like, oh, well, at least that's unexpected. I'll give it that. It was unexpected.
Is she a good mother?
No, come on.
I don't understand why she would just, like, would she not be welcomed with open arms by Saru to get, like, this, like, genius, like, scientist aboard their vessel to serve on as part of the Federation, even as a civilian doctor? But she's just cool hanging out at Navarre at the nunnery.
Yeah, I mean...
Why, Cam? That's what I keep asking when I'm watching this episode again. It's like, what are their motivations here? And I don't understand a lot of it, other than, guess what? Plot convenience.
The only thing that kind of makes sense with it is, this is a character who's obviously gone through trauma for a long, long time. And I wonder if this nunnery was the only place she felt she could find peace in her life again. And I can kind of go along with that. I can justify it in my head. Does this really make sense for a character that's been, you know, torn apart from her daughter for so long? Not really, but I can kind of understand. These Burnham, you know, this family, they like to go in their own direction, Tyler, and there is no looking back.
Cam, you can make sense of it in your head. Why don't the writers try to make sense of it to us, the viewers, though?
Well, usually they'll toss off one line of lip service and you go, okay.
But they didn't. Okay. They didn't.
Yeah.
This is bizarre behavior. It doesn't make sense, though. You know, and the thing, if we're expected to do math in our head constantly to understand what the character's motivations are, it's so goofy. And like, during the entire Quorum challenge that they're doing, I kept scribbling in my notes, this is the goofiest episode of Star Trek Discovery to date.
It was interesting. It felt like a very weird episode, and that when I'm watching it, I'm like, I can't tell if this is an episode that feels more confident and focused than some of the past ones, or if this is just the weirdest episode we've had so far. And I'm not sure where to come down in terms of supporting the weird or getting annoyed by the weird.
I just feel bad for the actress playing Gabrielle in that, like, she signs on for this role, you know, last season, she's in a cool spacesuit, and then they throw her in this nun's habit, and she has to exuberantly... break her daughter down into tears. Oh, I did a Burnham crying count in this episode, Cam. Guess how many times she cried?
Three?
Four, possibly five.
Okay. Yeah.
Could you imagine if you were watching, I don't know, say Star Trek Enterprise, and Archer cried five times in an episode?
Well, he did because he got beat up a lot.
That's true. That's true. You know, much better example. Could you imagine watching Star Trek Voyager and Janeway cried five times in a single episode?
No, not at all. And let's look at a character maybe who's like a more emotional character on a Star Trek show. Star Trek often has characters that are very intellectual, but who's a character known to be more emotional that we could point to and say, like, look, they didn't need to do that with that character.
I would say Deanna Troi or Tom Paris. Yeah. Those are the two that come to mind. Worf.
Yeah, Cass as well on Voyager. Yeah, like that's not, you might do that, you know, in a major high impact moment, maybe in like a two-parter or something, like a story that was very important, but not like this, where it's just like has there been an episode of Discovery so far this season where she didn't have a crying scene? Maybe not the premiere, I don't remember, but it seems like pretty much every episode.
Not episode two, because she was only on the view screen at the end, but I'm pretty sure it has happened in every single other episode. And yeah. Kim, you point out, like, it works if it's in a high impact moment, but if our main character is crying every single episode, it loses all impact, though. If I saw Captain Picard cry, as I did in Sarek, the episode from TNG Sarek, that is a high impact moment. That works for me. It drives home what he's going through. Her tears just kind of seem meaningless. Like, can I be honest? I'm not trying to be a jerk, but we all kind of have friends kind of cry at the drop of a hat. Should we just kind of give Burnham the benefit of the doubt in that maybe she's just one of those folks?
Maybe, although usually there's alcohol involved when there's the people that cry a lot.
Okay. Well, she even has like Tilly on board with crying. Tilly was sobbing at the end of this episode too.
Discovery is a very, like, every Star Trek show has its thing, right? And maybe that's what Discovery's thing will be at the end of the day. Saving the universe over and over again and crying.
Okay. Yeah, maybe we should get into the meat of the matter here. We get to return to Vulcan, a.k.a. Navarre. It's a thousand years since the founding of the Federation, and they're no longer part of the Federation. I love how Burnham exclaims, "They would never abandon us." Well, Burnham, they did. I've got a question, though. We knew when the Romulans were introduced back in the original series, it was a surprise for the Starfleet crew members to find out that the Romulans and Vulcans were like distant cousins, separated tribes. They had been wearing helmets throughout all of their encounters leading up to that. But Spock knew that Romulans and Vulcans were, related. Burnham grew up on Vulcan. Burnham was brother and sister with Spock. Did Burnham know? Like, because she seemed pretty surprised by this news when Admiral Vance Refrigeration was laying it all out.
Okay, so I was wondering about this in advance, because in the era where Discovery is a thing, back in the 23rd century, the mystery of the Romulans still exists. So obviously a lot of the Discovery crew would not know. But I did also wonder if Burnham might know. Given her reaction to finding this out, which was like a pretty amazing reaction shot, you could probably get some good GIFs or memes out of. She finds out, and she seemed legit blown away. So I would say she didn't know. Maybe Spock learned. I don't know. Did Spock learn after he parted with Burnham? Maybe, I guess. I don't know.
She goes all the way to Vulcan Science Academy, and this never comes up. I'm just wondering what the situation, and he goes off to Starfleet. So what is the situation in which he is privy to this information and she is not? He must have had to find out on Vulcan, right? Like, because people from Earth didn't have a clue.
Maybe it's like Book. They just don't know. They shrugged their shoulders.
Okay, just didn't care. Okay, I can maybe buy that. Speaking of Admiral Vance Refrigeration, he seems to be a huge fan of Burnham as of this episode.
He's totally on the Burnham train, 100%. Sorry, I just had one thing, though, I wanted to say about the Romulans, though. I mean, how likely is it, though, do you think that, say the Vulcans know that the Romulans look just like them, which they should, considering they have history books, do you think that secret would remain a secret in the universe?
Well, it didn't remain a secret in the universe.
Not for long, obviously, yeah. But like the Enterprise crew didn't know until Balance of Terror, right?
And I think afterwards, I can believe that it was then widespread following Balance of Terror. It's just leading up to, in between Enterprise and Discovery, any encounter with Romulans would have been conducted while they had helmets on their heads. It's just interesting because they also established that there were Vulcans serving in Starfleet during the Discovery era. It's not like Spock was the first Vulcan. We had a Vulcan admiral featured quite frequently in season two. Do the Vulcans just choose not to spill the beans? Or is it more like, I don't know, the entire 1701 crew just willingly, skipped that history lesson when they were in the Starfleet Academy?
Maybe we need to just accept the Worf line of dialogue. We don't discuss it with outsiders.
Okay. Well, Vance Refrigeration did say that it was forgotten by her time in, about their connection there. So I don't know. Right. It seems odd that a woman, a citizen of Navarre, or actually I like how Princess Tarina describes her as technically a citizen. Like, wow, that's kind of ethnocentric, let's say somebody moves to Canada from, I don't know, Taiwan, and they've lived here since they were 8, they're now 36, and Cam, would you go around calling them technically a citizen?
Only if I was a monster.
Yes. It's like, okay, yikes. She notes that particular point there. So it makes sense that Burnham would know this. Somebody would tell her, or it would come up at this Vulcan Science Academy. The only way I can figure is like, maybe it's a well-hidden secret and Sarek spilled the beans to Spock, who he didn't really get along with, but not to Burnham, who he did quite adore.
That I can kind of go along with. Like, it makes... It's, again, it kind of falls back on that headcanon thing where I'm like, I can justify this. Like, of things to be annoyed about in Discovery storytelling, stuff like this I can kind of look past.
I'm far less annoyed about this than I am with Gabrielle in this episode, which is just bizarre.
Yeah.
So I guess Admiral Vance, Vance Refrigeration, is an entirely new character as of this episode. Why, you ask? Well, I think the plot dictates it. They need to get them to Navarre somehow. I was excited about this prospect. When I saw Navarre, aka Vulcan, again for the first time in 1,000 years, I was like, oh, this is awesome. And then, Cam, we got an entire bottle episode in which they pretty much said to themselves, what if we took a mock time, but without any of the fun parts?
Yeah, and like, part honestly, when I was saying up front that I didn't know whether to support the weird or be annoyed by the weird, throughout this episode, I was really having trouble gauging what I thought of the episode, because I'm watching this whole Vulcan ceremony, and it's kind of what I like in Star Trek, where we go down to an alien culture, we examine an aspect of their society in depth, which we got a lot here. We got this whole Vulcan ceremony we've never seen before, and the show didn't just kind of, as Discovery often does, race through it in like 15 seconds and be like, okay, we did it, on to the next thing. They really like reveled in it with a lot of weird Star Trek canon into it. But like, you're right. When it was over, I just felt like, okay, I could appreciate that they were showing me something new with Vulcan society and that they'd evolved the, you know, Vulcan-Romulan relationship. But like, was I having fun with it? Was I, you know, like some of the great episodes, some of the other great talky episodes of Star Trek, you know, Measure of a Man or something like that. Was I having fun watching these characters go back and forth? Not really, because the problem is so much of how the show's written, Burnham, I think that's where it stops being fun.
If I'm watching Burnham's mother, you know, move her to tears and break her down, and let's say I'm a Starfleet officer in the redressed mess hall, and I'm one of Burnham's colleagues, and I'm watching her have like a meltdown in the middle, I would be sliding out that door as quickly as possible. Like that, could you imagine if you're at work, Cam, and you witnessed one of your colleague's mothers reducing your colleague to tears? Like, would you stand there just silently staring?
Well, my mother does it to me in front of my colleagues.
Fair enough. It's me that this scene was just incredibly awkward. Like, it didn't feel earned. And I keep kind of critiquing Discovery about whether the moments that they're trying to deliver, whether or not they feel earned or not. And this, it just didn't.
Well, the one thing I kind of liked about it was we start this episode and we have Burnham saying things like, you know, until I solve the burn, I won't have peace. And things like this. I'm like, oh my God, these grandiose statements coming out of this character are really wearing on me. You think of how many missions Kirk ran or Picard ran of the most vital importance that they pulled off. It's not like these characters walked around all day long being like, I need to save the world. I need to save the world over and over again. And the reason I kind of liked this was Burnham went into this intellectual back and forth with the Vulcans, kind of spouting that same thing. I'm the one that's going to save you all. I'm the one that needs this information. And the fact that the mother broke her down and exposed the uncertainties and the like the vulnerabilities in the character, I could appreciate, because it was basically getting rid of this God complex Burnham that we've been dealing with the first, well, I mean, I guess most of this season, quite frankly. So like, maybe it's not done the most elegantly, or in a way that is particularly fun to watch, but I could at least say, well, at least it strikes down that aspect of the character that's getting on my nerves.
And what you're talking about is all character-based stuff, which is what I'm drawn to. But yeah. The problem is, if you have an entire episode where the story is centered around, you know, beating talk of the burn into our heads again and again and again, like, we're all sick of hearing about the burn and why the burn is important. The burn is the most important thing. I can do the math in my head. I can make sense of it in my head. And that's to the writers already know that in order to restore the Federation, you need to find the cause of the burn. But how come Burnham is so convinced of this? Like, what if they find the cause of the burn and it doesn't mean anything? Like, it will mean something. It'll mean something incredible. And the reason I know that is because the writers think so. And episode after episode, you know, everything always works out for Burnham, no matter what her decisions are. Everything always just works out in the end. Case in point, this episode, she withdraws her quorum dealio. And guess what? President Tarina gives her the data because she kind of did it was a whole King Solomon sort of deal, right? Where like she's just like, right. Okay, I can see the sacrifice you're willing to make. Here you go. And I'm just like, yeah, that's what I figured would happen. Were you shocked that Burnham got the data at the end?
No, I wasn't. Yeah, like I made a note very early in the episode, really. I think it was the scene where, you know, her and Book laying in bed. And of course, you know, on top of bringing up brother things, she's also just starts talking about the burn. I'm like, boy, does this character ever stop talking about the burn? That would get really tiresome. But I made a note that said Burnham has clearly read the season finale. Because this character knows how important the burn is to this season and how it's going to affect everything going forward. Whereas the other cast members have not read the finale.
I think that is a genius way of articulating what's going on and the frustrations that I'm feeling here with the writing of this season, though. And it's the same stuff that was bugging us with the Red Angel last season, in which the writers clearly knew the importance of the Red Angel. But you kick off episode one and all you are told is the Red Angel is important, but you're never told why, and it's never explained why. And it's like, okay, I get it. Burnham will be proven correct in the end. She'll be validated. We'll find out that whatever the cause of the burn is, it will help unite the Federation as it once was to its former glory, blah, blah, blah. But they're not spelling out why that is, even though Burnham seems to be convinced of that. And so you fall into the trap of Burnham is always ultimately validated, no matter what kind of shenanigans she's getting into with, you know, mutiny or what have you. She's always validated.
Yeah. And it's like you've brought up, you know, where it's like, how does this character know for certain? I mean, I said it's because she's read the finale, but, you know, from a standpoint of writing this character, just from the writers in the room, how does this character know so emphatically that this is the thing? Like, what if I just walked around saying, I am going to stop the Black Plague in Europe? You know, you'd be like, well, Cam, why? Because I have to. Clearly, I have to. And you'd be like, are you insane?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, really, is there something wrong with you? I'm like, you don't understand because you aren't on the right page. I have to stop the Black Plague.
Well, it's actually, like, let me develop that metaphor a little bit with you here. It's more yeah. like you announcing, I need to find out the exact rat that began to spread the bubonic plague. And then I know that's how I can stop Brexit and reunite Europe once again.
Correct. Yeah, that really nails it down. Thank you very much. Yes. So like, I'm going on a rat hunt. And it's like, you would have me committed to a mental asylum. You'd be yes. like, there's something very wrong with him. He's like wandering around sewers looking for like rat DNA and skeletons of times gone past. Like, what's wrong with this guy?
I had so much hope for season three going in, and I'm just, this mystery stuff is just like, it's just making me like want to pull my eyeballs out because it's not good writing.
Can we save this season? Like, I think we can have good episodes, you know, week to week. I think we could have some good episodes, kind of like last season of Picard, you know, we had Nepenthe, which I thought was a fantastic episode. And yeah. I have very warm memories about that episode and how I feel about it. But
that's just the pizza oven you're thinking of.
Toasty warm. But when it comes to Discovery, I really do wonder at this point if the revelation of the burn can pay off in a way where I walk away feeling positive about the season overall versus just picking out, like Picard, some key episodes that I really enjoyed. You know, like the one where we went to Trill, for example.
I think what's going to happen is they'll have a revelation of the burn. It might be something cool, but we'll get the writers patting themselves on the backs ad infinitum as a result. And I'm just like, well, you guys aren't realizing that you're stringing your viewers along for weeks on end in a very frustrating fashion, in like storytelling that is not necessarily satisfying from a holistic level. Like, believe me, there's moments in this episode that I like, that I enjoy. There I can pick up moments from all over season three so far that I've really, really liked. But holistically, I just get frustrated. And I don't think that they're going to be able to justify this entire journey that's very frustrating because of a reveal that might actually be kind of cool by the time we get to the end of it. But I'm also skeptical about just how cool this reveal is going to be, just like us finding out that, you know, Burnham was the Red Angel.
Right. And as Burnham kept going on and on and on about the burn throughout this episode, it was interesting how we had these scenes with her and Tilly. Because season one, the relationship between Burnham and Tilly, I thought had a lot of meaning to it. And I thought was pretty powerful emotionally in terms of friendships on Star Trek. I really liked it a lot. And I made a note, again, you know, as I'm watching this episode, that said, are these two even very close friends? I feel like the whole Burnham-Tilly friendship has almost completely gone by the wayside. We did get, like, you know, a scene in this season where they talked about cake. We had, like, a moment or two in season two. But, like, I don't know. Are these two best friends? I don't know. Apparently they room together. I don't know.
Yeah, well, we debated that a couple weeks ago about whether they were still roomies. We got confirmation, even on a skeleton crew of just about 70 people or so. I guess they still want a room together.
Mm-hmm.
That's enough. But beyond that, I'm trying to pick out moments from the season that really exemplifies their friendship. The only thing I can think of, though, is the cake is eternal line, which you just mentioned. And I guess when they sob into each other's shoulders when Tilly accepts the acting first officer role.
Well, there's a lot of scenes, you know, with sobbing where you'll have Burnham and Tilly have been separated, whether it's, you know, like the start of the season or by a major event, maybe last season. And we get like a tearful reunion or something like that where they hug each other. But I feel like that's what this friendship almost consists of now. And I was really pondering to myself, like, well, you know, we've did an episode on friendships in Star Trek. And, you know, you look at like Geordi and Data. Not every episode is Geordi and Data, you know, palling around and goofing off. But there's enough of them that you can see the foundation and the evolution of this friendship and how it's consistent. Whereas like the Tilly Burnham stuff, there's vast swaths of the first three seasons where I'm like, I don't know. I feel like Tilly's better friends with some of these other characters like Stamets.
Well, the problem is with this show is if you're not in Burnham's orbit because of story reasons, you really do fall by the wayside. And we had the season two's story arc with May and Tilly. As soon as May was dispatched, Tilly kind of faded to the background quite a bit in season two, shockingly so. And again, that's why I'm really trying to scratch my head, think of a lot of examples of what makes them best buds at this point.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just a lot of it seems to be these kind of heartfelt talks after a momentous event has happened, which I don't know. Like, I kind of miss the small talk and the goofing around we got in season one.
Well, speaking of Tilly, I'm totally down for Saru bumping her up to acting first officer, despite her being an ensign. I think it could be fun putting that character in a different situation, which I love seeing, giving her something to do, which we didn't see in the back half of season two. And do you think Saru at least bumps her up to full lieutenant after this? Not even lieutenant junior grade, but give her both solid pips, so to speak?
He has to, right?
I hope so.
The show's shown an interest in having characters, you know, move around on the ship. So I would hope so. I did like that this decision to make her an acting first officer. Initially, when it started happening, I was like, really? Like, that's the go-to? I mean, we did have that moment where he said, you know, Tilly, the best first impression I know, or whatever it was. You're always a good first impression.
Yeah, yeah.
In the second episode of the season. So I'm like, okay, there's a foundation for this. I'm kind of like questioning it a little. It seems kind of strange considering some of the other characters on the ship, but let's go with it. But I liked that the episode grappled with it and had moments of Tilly going to say Stamets and saying, you know, what do you think? And he's like, it would be weird. Like, I did enjoy that the show didn't just immediately cut to the whole crew clapping. I liked that it actually dealt with it on a character level of some people being like, huh, well, this is different.
Cam. Say yes. Say yes. Say yes.
Say yes.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, I thought that was incredibly awkward.
Okay. And I know exactly why it's awkward. It's awkward because they all say the exact same thing. Yes, until you get to it. Detmer. Yes, Detmer says something different. She says, like, just do it or something like that. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if she actually said the Nike slogan, but but that one felt natural. The rest of them all felt like these really stilted, awkward kind of just, we're all going to repeat this mantra. It was weird.
It was kind of play acting. And the other awkward moment is, like, you could see a lot of people still working on their consoles while there's a whole other, you know, cohort of people standing there at attention. And so it's like, clearly these people really weren't supporting Tilly becoming their first officer. So I got a laugh out of that.
Those are the ones who are against it wholeheartedly.
Like, yeah. You could hear them grumbling underneath their breath. So no.
I think it would have been better if you had a character to say yes, and everyone started applauding. Like, just go with that. And someone yells out, like, just do it or whatever. Yeah. Like, it was awkward having this, like, camera cutting to individual characters as each one says, say yes.
A slight segue, but the entire time I was thinking of Ensign Tilly becoming first officer, I was just picturing Wesley on the Enterprise ordering Worf around. Like, that would be an amazing episode.
Yes, it would. And I mean, I guess we had, you know, obviously in the JJ verse, we had Kirk getting launched up the old ranking system pretty quickly. So I can totally go with this one as well, especially when we've seen Tilly prove herself far more than Kirk did in those films. It was a surprise, but I guess it probably made the most sense, because when you think about the ongoing cast of characters, I don't know who else you would have really put up as a candidate for first officer, unless it's someone who is not a major screen time character, you know, like Nelson or whatever.
Well, let's go through who our options would have been. We have Stamets. I can understand him not being first officer. We've got Culber. Well, he's a doctor, probably not immediate first officer material. Then we've got the bridge crew that's, if we're being honest, they really don't have distinctive characteristics other than, like, they're all babes and hunks, you know? Beyond that, we've got Jet Reno. I can understand her not being first officer. And I can also understand her not showing up to tell Tilly to say yes.
Or just showing up for duty, period.
Yeah. I think your only other option would have been Linus.
That would have been amazing. Yeah. Maybe I'm the most in favor of that, of just, like, Linus popping in and out of scenes.
Okay, so we've got the hunks and the babes on the bridge crew, but none of them really have personalities, except for Linus. I think, and he's, like, Burnham's assistant science officer, so it's like, but is Linus, like, the most well-developed, like, supporting character, because you've got Giorgio, who occasionally pops up as, you know, special guest star, or same with Jet Reno or what have you, but is it really Linus out of the ancillary crew?
Does Linus have a personality, or is he just very specific in his behavior?
If you ask
that's
me,
the thing I wonder,
to describe Reese or Bryce without asking me to describe what they look like or any of their physical features, I would have a very tough time. If you asked me to describe Linus, I'd be like, yeah, he's goofy. He gets himself in trouble. You know, sometimes he's prone to fits of sneezing. You know, that's our goofy Linus. We all love him. And he loves a good beetle while you're at it.
I mean, I feel like Detmer's the closest of the other, the bridge crew. But, like, you're right. When I'm asked to describe the Detmer personality versus how she fits into plot moments and stuff like that, I don't know that I could really describe her personality.
Well, her personality, I remember episode 3, she snarls at Burnham. And this season, she has PTSD, but which seems to be cured as of this episode. But beyond that, I can't tell you anything about her personality.
I feel like the bridge crew are kind of just like the cheerleader squad. Their job on the show is to cheer and just look at happy for everyone.
Cam, the amount of cheering that went on in seasons 1 and 2 was something to behold. We haven't heard as much cheering in season 3 when the crew succeeds at a mission.
No, and I think it's really funny to think of how much they cheer on this show and then cut to, like, the TNG bridge.
Yeah.
There's like no cheering whatsoever.
Could you imagine, you know, Picard going, hurrah!
Or everyone just turning and cheering Picard in like every second episode. It would be pretty funny.
The one moment, though, was in Star Trek Generations where they destroy the Bird of Prey and Data goes, yes.
Right.
That was it.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, okay. Mystery solved to a certain degree. We were questioning why on earth Rachel Antrell was in the main credits. You know, of course, she had been playing, I'm even blanking on the security officer's name, Cam. Save me here.
Nan.
She had been playing Nan, transfers into the future, and then decides to go hang out on a seed vault for an indefinite period of time for some reason because of Barzan culture. Here's the deal. They obviously wanted Tilly to become first. Again, the writers have read the season-long outline. They know what has to happen. But I think a lot of people would have been questioning Saru's judgment if they had bumped up Tilly when you have Nan as a far more qualified candidate, if I'm just out of all the skeleton crew that remains on Discovery.
I agree with you. It makes far more sense in terms of the dynamics of the organization. But I feel like within, you know, the hearts and minds of most viewers, you know, the average viewer, they would completely support Tilly because that's the character who's been there the whole time versus a Nan who only pops in and out every, you know, handful of episodes.
But like hearts and minds of viewers, that's one thing. But I think logically the writers realized they were going to have to shift Nan out of the picture. Otherwise, it just would have been absolutely bizarre for her not to be first officer in this situation.
Yeah, no, I agree. Especially with, you know, Nan had a lot to do. Well, not a lot to do, but she had a lot of key moments near the end of the second season and the early parts of this season that would show that this character does have that sort of strength of leadership that would make a lot of sense as a first officer.
Could we argue that if she was still around, that she would probably be the most well-developed ancillary character, ancillary crew member aboard Discovery?
Yeah, I think she was a pretty specific personality, like Linus. So that work was kind of already done for them.
Yeah. My only other candidate, I guess, would have been Nilsson, just because I believe Nilsson is a full lieutenant, whereas I believe Owashikin and Detmer are both junior lieutenants, if I recall correctly. Right. So, yeah, okay. So we've got that solved. Oh, Cam, what do you think of the Navari? I guess that's what is there a proper term for the people from Navar now? Do we call them the Navari? Was that made reference to?
I think we call them the Navi.
Navi, thank you. They're not blue enough. Tails aren't long enough. But
yeah, I guess so. You know, I remember when we were talking about Picard season one, before the season came out, and trying to predict what that show would be about, and I'd said it only made sense. I think you said the same, that it's about maybe the unification effort that Picard had started back in the episodes, Unification on TNG. That makes a lot of sense to be kind of his final act, you know, I think at this point we thought he was maybe with Starfleet, so we thought maybe as sort of representing Starfleet. And watching this episode, I actually am kind of glad we didn't do like a season arc on this versus being able to kind of have the events, all the kind of the signing of papers and whatever, just to get there dealt with and in the background, so we can deal with what it actually means and where we are now. Maybe this episode wasn't the most riveting in terms of paying that off, but I did actually enjoy being able to just get to the point versus dealing with all the diplomatic discussions just to, you know, merge these two races.
And we do know, because it took Spock a couple hundred years, that it means that, I guess, Picard, we could have episodes in which he deals with this ongoing issue, but it's not going to be resolved within his series.
Yeah, and I'm okay with that.
What did you think of Jean-Luc getting a shout out in this episode from his logs, in which apparently he's recording Spock wherever he goes on Romulus?
He was very bored.
Okay. I'm just picturing him with like a GoPro and be like, oh, you know what? Can you get step back? The light's not perfect. Okay, there you go. There you go, Spock. Okay. Continue on. I'm listening.
I did enjoy watching them watch YouTube.
Yes. Was this like the best follow-up to Assignment Earth that we could have ever hoped for?
It's up there. I did like this moment, though. I thought it took a moment that could have been really just kind of like clunky fan service. And just seeing the emotion of Burnham seeing her brother that many years later, like, I did think that landed fairly well.
Yeah, okay. I dug it. She did talk a lot about Spock, and I guess they just want to make sure that we're still energized for Strange New Worlds, hopefully, I don't know, coming late 2021, early 2022.
Hopefully, yeah. What did you think of the fact we were back to visiting the elements of Absolute Candor, the kind of
Absolute Candor
Picard episode? Yeah, Absolute Candor, thank you, the word I keep mispronouncing. Absolute Candor. Censor. Yeah, I thought I was kind of stunned that we were back doing Absolute Candor material. I was like, oh my god, we're going back there already, huh?
I think
did not ever see that coming.
Profoundly overestimated the fan enthusiasm for that rather so-so episode.
Did Kirsten Beyer write that episode?
She did, yes.
Okay, yeah,
and
there you go.
And she wrote this one as well. Cam, yeah. I still haven't seen evidence of her writing a fantastic Star Trek script.
What do you think her best one is? I think it is
It might be this one, honestly.
Yeah.
And
this
I think
or Candor.
Candor.
As soon as I said it, I knew that was coming.
I'm going to keep at you until you get it.
Yeah, one day, it'll be like symbiote or whatever.
Yeah. No, you, for the longest time, you do pronounce Burnham's name correctly now, but I remember the first half of season one, you called her Burnham, which was, I got a laugh out of that. What do you think about kind of the depictions of the Romulans versus Vulcans versus Romulo-Vulcans that we saw here? The first Romulo-Vulcan sighting since Drumhead, I believe.
Yeah, I enjoyed getting to see just them represented through these three characters on this, you know, this board talking to Burnham. I enjoyed just getting to see the three of them together. Just felt kind of cool. Like, it felt like an aspect of Star Trek that's been a long time coming, and to actually see it represented was exciting. I, again, was sitting there going, I was torn between being like, I wish I could see so much more of this and, you know, not have to deal with the burn stuff. Like, just dealing with this society could be really cool. But then I also was then flashing back to Picard and being like, do I want more Romulans? I don't know.
Well, one of the things I was wondering, though, is like, as we see these three groups squabble and bicker, I was thinking in my head, like, so how's that unification going, Spock? It's like, it's like, should they be on the same planet living, you know, in communion? Like, it doesn't seem as if it's working.
It'll be interesting to see just in the future of the Star Trek franchise, how much we continue to explore, you know, this planet and being a thing versus just, you know, future Star Trek just going backwards again. Like, I am curious if we continue into the 33rd, 34th century, or if we wind up with, you know, visiting, say, like the 26th century or something like that in future Star Trek, you know, iterations.
I'm just far more interested in popping in on Cardassia and seeing how maybe the Federation has influenced Cardassia post-Dominion War. That would be interesting. But it didn't clue into me until the second time I watched this episode. But the Romulan representative, not, you know, Takir was the Vulcan, which it was funny when they kept calling him Pierre Takir. I'm blanking on the Romulan's name, the full-on Romulan, the bald guy. But his voice had like that Lorne Michaels accent to it. You know, most people might be most familiar with him. It's essentially the inspiration for Dr. Evil from Austin Powers. Did you at all pick up on kind of this weird semi-transatlantic Canadian accent that the Romulan actor was doing?
I really didn't. I tend to pick up more on the fact that so it's like, you know, when they were making like the Planet of the Apes new movies, they sent all the actors to like ape school, or when they were making the movie Cats, they sent all the actors to Cats school. I feel like a lot of actors who pop up on Star Trek get sent to Vulcan school, which is like this template way to behave as a, you know, Vulcan or a Romulan in this case as well. that is not that interesting. Whereas when you look at the actors who really succeeded playing these characters, they played them in an interesting way that felt original. You know, when I look at, you know, Jolene Blaylock as T'Pol or obviously Nimoy as Spock.
Well, yeah, T'Kir was totally aping, you know, the Tim Russ voice in his delivery. I did think that Tarina, the president, was a little more interesting in her portrayal, but it's not like she blew me away, for that matter.
Yeah, I thought she was probably the highlight for me in terms of characters we saw in this episode. But, you know, you just go back to, like, Journey to Babel. And obviously Spock's on that show. And then we meet Sarek. And Sarek feels like such a distinct personality instantly. Like, there's not a moment where you're like, boy, these Vulcans all sound the same. They feel like two completely, you know, unique individuals. And I miss that aspect of Vulcans. It does feel, and I don't blame this on Discovery. I blame this on really TNG kind of onwards, of just having this sort of template behavior for Vulcans in terms of how they speak versus kind of finding interesting ways to tackle how a Vulcan behaves through kind of a bit of a different approach to the dialogue or just to the mannerisms in which they speak.
Well, before we get over to Bounty Hunter School with the Cam DeLorton report, we've got a special guest beaming in to offer his thoughts on this episode of Star Trek Discovery.
Okay, and joining us, my co-host on the Spy Hards podcast, Mr. Scott Hardy.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for coming back. Now, Scott, we've been tackling this Unification Part 3, an episode that I think has a lot of people talking on either sides of the fence, you know, whether they like it or hate it. Where do you come down?
I started off being very reticent about this episode, especially because they had the chutzpah to say Unification 3, you know, trying to be a third part of my beloved Unification two-parter. And for the first 10 minutes of this episode, I was on the ropes. I was not enjoying it. And then at some point, the magic just hit. And I really, really enjoyed this episode. It's probably my favorite of the season so far.
Wow. Okay. That's fascinating. What was it about, maybe, was it the Navarre mythology that gripped you? What sucked you into this one?
It just felt like they had some emotion and stakes that felt genuine. It was a bottle episode. It actually dealt with something. It didn't have countless deaths like every other episode of Discovery. I mean, yes, I know people playing the bingo at home, Michael Burnham did cry again, but so did everyone else. So maybe this time it's fine.
I'm crying right now.
When I saw Jet Reno crying, that really got to me as well.
But I love the world building of Navarre and seeing what happened to the unification of the two species. I thought that was great. I was worried when I heard the what's the name of that Romulan sect, the Malat something Malat.
Oh, the Kwat Malat.
Yeah,
rolls like off the Irish tongue, version. Doesn't it?
It really does. When I heard that mentioned, I had Picard PTSD, and I was really worried. But that was Michael Burnham's mum was probably one of my favorite bits of the episode.
Oh, no, that's interesting because, yeah, we came down, I think, a little more up in the air on that one. So you were excited with how they brought this character back.
Yeah, I mean, Michael doesn't owe her anything particularly. You know, she's never been around. She thought she was dead. But I felt like if you were going to bring her back anyway, this is probably an interesting way of doing it instead of having this, like, MacGuffin, though they chase her instead for the rest of the season, like Spock. And like I said, I was really worried at the start because they did the whole classic JJ / whatever you call this Kurtzman verse thing of not answering a simple question, which is, you know, what caused the burn and what why is Navarre withholding the data? Oh, because they are. I don't like that sort of mystery box nonsense. But then it actually kind of got into it. I enjoyed it.
Scott, I've got a simple question for you. Mm-hmm. Why doesn't Dr. Gabrielle Burnham want to spend time with her daughter? Why would she rather go back to the Kwat Malat nunnery?
Well, did she know she existed?
Oh, yeah. Remember the daughter, or Burnham thought that her parents had been killed by the Klingons.
Yeah.
So Gabrielle had, you know, raised her for 8 years and disappears for another, you know, 25 years and is briefly reunited with Burnham last season and gets to see her long lost daughter once again. And then she's just happy to take off out of Discovery and go back to Navarre and just chill there with Kuat Malat instead of spending time with this daughter that she, you know, was not able to, you know, raise.
I could argue, I'm not going to try and argue all of their choices for them, but I, in my head, the mother landed before Burnham came back. So she's obviously given herself to the Romulan sect that I can't remember the name of again, or pronounce. But maybe there's that agreement, she can't break it. But I understand that, doing it, giving it, you know, taking an oath makes sense.
What happens if she does break it?
Hey, you don't want to know, Tyler. You okay. do not want to know.
I'm just saying, if I'm a human and I join an alien nunnery because they heal me, but my long-lost daughter comes back, I'm more than happy to split and go spend time with my long-lost daughter.
Well, I can see you're being absolutely full of candor right now.
Wait, wait. You'd be a very poor Romulan nun.
Wait, Cam, what did Scott just say to me?
Oh, geez. Yes, I know.
Okay. Sorry. I do appreciate, like, Discovery doing the bottle episode. Cam and I, we kind of get bored with, like, the nonstop action sequences where it's just kind of brute forcing your way out of situations. I'm much more interested in these kinds of episodes, smaller in scale, of course. Scott, do you have confidence that they will keep going in this direction in the like, obviously you need to cut down on the budget after, you know, those two Iceland episodes or what have you, but what are your hopes for the remainder of season three?
My hopes for the remainder of season three is that they at least try and to keep this level of okay writing, because it's been a very rocky season for me so far.
Well, you're saying this was your favorite so far. I mean, had you felt like there was any other highlights, or had it kind of been week to week, just kind of frustrating, and this was the one that sort of was a little bit of a spark of life?
This was, like I said, I went into this episode, the first 10 minutes, I was worried that this would be another episode of Discovery that I just wouldn't like. And it proved itself that it was actually okay further on in the episode, and I was happy with that. But, I mean, do you guys remember a time, maybe more Tyler than Cam, because Tyler, you were watching it with me back in the day when Enterprise and Voyager were airing on TV.
Yes, we had sleepovers together.
We did, yeah. Yeah. Top and tail. Yeah, I was at the head. Good days, good times.
Of course.
Do you remember being excited about watching Star Trek every week?
Yes, because I never knew what to expect next. Whether it was Deep Space Nine and you had the serialized storytelling, you could have a Vic Fontaine episode that would take you out of the Dominion War. Every episode was a surprise.
Right. And how do you feel about Star Trek now? I'm going to take Lower Decks out of the equation because you both know I've really loved that show.
Well, you know, why don't we jump over to Lower Decks and maybe your thoughts on Star Trek Picard. We'll touch on that in a few moments. But to answer your question, when I'm going into Discovery, it's, if I'm being honest, it's more with trepidation in that, like, I wonder if we're going to have an episode devoted entirely to people screaming about the burn, what is the burn? Or if it's going to be just a story-heavy episode, one light on the character moments, where I'm somebody who digs the character moments. I still think the biggest triumph of Star Trek Discovery was Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad. And it was an all character-based episode rather than an oftentimes confusing storyline. So, well, I like Discovery, but mostly because I like the characters. I have been saying this since season one. I don't think stories are its strong suit. So that's my long-winded answer to your question there, Scott.
Yeah, so I suppose I'm coming into it worried every week now. Like, I have to defend it, almost. I'm concerned about what they're going to output. So at least this episode didn't make me agree with my own concerns. I was surprised that they did something good.
Well, okay, let me say this, though. In the last couple weeks, though, I actually feel as unshackled as Burnham has after hanging out with Book for a year, in that, like, if I don't have these super high expectations, I was telling Cam earlier, you know, like I kind of like the idea of doing these podcasts, even if I have frustrations with Discovery, and that like I can kind of pick apart what works for me from a storytelling perspective and what does not. And that's actually helped me with kind of critical thinking skills when it comes to media. And so I kind of look forward to what it could be about Discovery that frustrates me versus delights me, because there were moments in this episode that definitely delighted me. A lot of it has to do with Saru and Tilly, honestly, but I feel unburdened from having like this big weight on my shoulders about having to kind of defend Discovery to a certain degree. Like I felt almost as if the first two seasons, I felt I was in kind of defensive mode of Discovery, like saying, probably giving it the benefit of the doubt more often than I think it deserved.
Right. Yeah. Like I felt somewhat similarly. Like I really enjoyed Discovery season one, even though there was tons of problems, and I saw so much online, and I'm not just talking about like the toxic troll stuff. I saw a lot of very smart people writing essays about, you know, how lousy Discovery was. And it was like, oh, like I'm enjoying the character aspect so much that I can't come down where these people are, even if I understand a lot of the criticisms they have tied to things like Lorca twists and all that sort of stuff. And it kind of continued through season two. This is the first season where I feel more so frustrated by the show, but not in the way I did with Picard, where at a certain point, Picard felt like a slog to me. Discovery doesn't feel like a slog to me at all yet. It's just like, I know that there's life to the show. I know it has it in it to pull off, you know, some really great stories and maybe take the show in some really great directions. And I'm just waiting for that to happen.
But at what point do you hit the insanity level?
Where
you're just waiting for it to get better?
I think, so what I've kind of realized, and this is just within a short time ago though, is this is Star Trek Discovery. Like this is how they want to do storytelling. It's going to be the mystery box stuff every single season. I feel unshackled to a certain degree. If I can just accept it for as it is and enjoy the moments when they do come up that are brilliant, then I can look forward to those aspects. So I don't want to be too confined in having to love this show as much as I love, say, DS9 or TNG or Enterprise, etc. Or, you know what, like Lower Decks as well really impressed me with what they managed to accomplish and fit within kind of the spirit of Star Trek as well.
Well, because I reached out to the two of you about coming on to talk about this episode particularly. And the reason I reached out, the main reason was because I came out of this episode with a good feeling about it and wanting to see more next week. And I haven't done that with any episode so far this season.
That's interesting.
And I didn't want to come on and just bash an episode. I we all could do that.
That's what I've been doing the last couple of weeks.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. No, it was actually interesting, Scott, because Cam and I, we were like, well, Scott either really has something positive to say or something very negative to say about this episode. And that's why he's excited to come on.
Yeah, it was just a case of, I think this week they got it right when it came to the character stuff. You can almost, as you said earlier, kind of put the mystery box stuff to one side. As long as they get the character stuff right and you can follow along and you're interested, you can kind of forgive the rest. And this is the first episode for me where I gave a monkey's about everyone and what they were doing. Even Burnham. And she rubbed me the wrong way most of the time.
Right.
But I actually cared. And I cared about her journey through that trial. And you know, overcoming these barriers and the walls that she's putting up in front of herself, I understood that.
Does it frighten you though that at this point it's very obvious that the entire season is going to revolve around the mystery of the burn, and we won't really be able to be released from that orbit until it's resolved by the end of the season?
Well, you just said it. You have to just sort of release yourself from worrying about that. It's just what the show is.
Yeah,
it's never going to change.
That may get really old when they're in, like, even next season, if they are repeating the same sort of mystery box thing. It's like, how many times can you do this before it feels repetitive? Because, like, the mysteries are so shallow that it gets really old. It's not like, you know, you're cranking out a great Agatha Christie, you know, story every single time. It's like it's like a one word thing. It's like Control, the Red Angel, the burn. It's like these things don't mean anything. Like it's not like this, you know, tapestry of storytelling. It's just like throwing out a buzzword over and over again through a season, which I'm not against them doing a mystery through a season, but if you don't pull off the mystery, it's very frustrating.
Yeah. Maybe we can segue over to your thoughts on, say, why don't we start with Star Trek Lower Decks? Get this into kind of positive territory here, Scott. But Lower Decks, 10 episodes, first animated comedy, first comedy for Star Trek. What did you take away from that series in its first season?
I absolutely loved this show. I had a feeling I would going into it, and I have already gone back and watched the season again since. I cannot speak highly enough about this show, and yet it's not available in the UK. But we'll forgive that. It should be sorted at some point.
Well, I'm impressed that you keep flying to North America every week to watch it. So there you go.
Hey, I mean, we just keep on having sleepovers, me and you.
Yeah, that's true.
It's quarantining together.
What is it about Star Trek Lower Decks that works for you? Like, what's pulling you into the series that maybe a Discovery is not doing?
I think it's just not taking itself so seriously.
Yeah.
I you know, everything is the end of the universe in Discovery, and we'll get to Picard. Whereas Lower Decks, they spend an episode trying to get a guy back to a medical place and there's a talking dog.
Yeah.
Okay, great. I'm on board. There's a one on a holodeck that's basically just a movie. Great. This is fun. Back to the days of like Nth Degree, where Barclay's frolicking around and on the holodeck, yeah, that sort of stuff. Just fun episodes where it's not that serious.
Well, jumping off of that, doesn't it kind of remind you of the anticipation of watching, you know, next week's Voyager or Deep Space Nine, where you didn't necessarily know what was going to happen next?
Yeah, and that's the feeling I got every week waiting for Lower Decks to come out, was I'm excited to see what they come up with next, and I was never, ever disappointed.
Do you think that Strange New Worlds maybe has the potential to carry that on as far as the live action series go?
I think it has the potential. It certainly has the cast to do it and has the right idea. I just hope that the team they put behind it are able to put that sort of content out. Because they had a good team with Mike McMahon in Lower Decks. They still do, I should say. But, you know, when you're doing a live action TV show and it's Star Trek and you've got, you know, the actors that they've got in Strange New Worlds, I could see them going more the Discovery Picard route. Unfortunately, I just don't want it to happen.
Well, I wonder, does Lower Decks have the DS9 advantage? It's kind of like, you know, the outsider of the group. All eyes are on a Picard series or Discovery. You know, Discovery is their flagship Trek show. Whereas Lower Decks, kind of a weird idea. You know, it's got an animation crew that aren't all these big names. And I just wonder if Lower Decks has the freedom to do really great stories kind of on their own without being bothered too much. Whereas there's so many hands, you know, working on the formulas for these Picard and Discovery seasons.
I think that's a very good point. You know, I think that a lot of these live action producers, they have no experience in animation. So they're like, wash our hands of it. Let them go off and like let Mike McMahon and company go off and do their own thing. And we'll just sit back and watch.
Yeah,
I buy that. And also at the same time, I think they just picked a good team to run that show. Mike McMahon had a history of loving Star Trek and understanding Star Trek and comedy. So what better combination?
Yeah, totally.
Well, speaking of combinations, what about the combination of about four different creators on Star Trek Picard?
Well, I haven't been on this show in a while. Usually I'm on once or twice a year, but because of COVID, we haven't been together in Vegas. So you haven't really heard on the show what I think about Picard, although I've telegraphed it already. That show was a dumpster fire.
I think you're the trash. Second guest in a row to describe it as that. Yes,
I mean, I am part of the Co-op Milad or whatever it is. I practice absolute candor, and
it's a lost cause.
It's an absolute lost cause. I bonded myself to it. You're right. I had so much high hopes in that first episode. It felt like it was doing something, and then it just pummeled me over the head, and then ripped my eye out, shot my, you know, family. And then it tried to lift me off the ground a little bit with Nepenthe, tease me back up again, and then just beat the crap out of me.
It was kind of like throwing the ball up in the air before he hit it with the baseball bat.
They were trying to kick me like I was a football at the end. It was...
How many sports metaphors can we work into this one?
The show almost felt as if it was kind of depression porn or something. Like, it just wanted to wallow in its own dark energy, dark, you know, kind of view of the universe, which didn't really jive with why we were, you know, drawn into Star Trek in the first place.
No, we wanted an escape from the dark stuff.
It was a dark page in the Star Trek book.
Oh. Yeah.
The problem I have, though, is like the creators of the show seem to be very pleased with themselves. And I there's a lot of interviews, and they seem to be lecturing fans against their negative responses, saying like, well, it's supposed to be dark, so that by the time we get to the end and the optimism comes through, I get to the end, the finale was kind of a stinker, and I didn't feel as if it really resolved a lot of the threads that had come up. And guess what? I wasn't even interested in all the threads that they brought up throughout the preceding 9 episodes either. So it's just, I don't understand how the creative team behind this is just so pleased with themselves in Star Trek Picard.
But basically, you look at like Michael Chabon, and he was very upfront about when he was writing the show, he'd just lost his father, right? And yeah. So he was dealing with grief. And this entire season was grief.
Right.
What I can't understand is how they managed to get Patrick Stewart to come back and play his and act out Michael Chabon's grief on screen.
Baffles me that Patrick Stewart did this, but I think what we understand is that he had signed on for a different story idea, and then they kind of threw that in to the trash and went with this, and I guess he's already signed on to his contract, but or maybe he drank the Kool-Aid and thought this was all brilliant.
You and I and Cam, we were all there in the room when Patrick Stewart came walking out onto the stage in Las Vegas, right?
Yep.
Do you remember that sense of jubilation and joy?
I'll Cam never forget it.
Sprung from his feet, and it was like I was at the Ed Sullivan show with the Beatles coming up on stage, just looking at Cam.
He was just screaming away. I could hear it from the other side of the room.
And his beehive haircut was just bobbing back and forth.
He kept throwing his underwear at Patrick Stewart. I don't know why.
Well, I know why.
Well, but that feeling, and much as I'll use the term you just came up with, it was thrown in the trash.
I just don't know how they messed up so giantly in this situation.
And I'm sure we're going to have a lot more fun in season 2 with, fake Picard.
Yeah. Well, how do you feel about the fact that we're watching this Gollum? Yeah. You know, like, did you even care when the real Picard even died?
No, because they told me he had a body waiting for him.
Yeah, exactly. So it lost all meaning when that moment happened. We watched the death of Picard. The death of Captain Kirk hits me more emotionally than the death of Captain Picard.
Yeah, I think the death of Captain Picard, or Admiral Picard, or Jean-Luc Picard, was akin to maybe the death of Kes.
Okay.
But it wasn't the greatest gift.
The greatest gift was when the show ended.
Okay, well, Scott, we should talk a little bit just to let you do a plug for the Spyhards podcast. For those that don't know who are listening to this right now, what is the Spyhards podcast and why are we doing it?
Well, if you want some positive thoughts about spy movies, far less negative stuff, sorry about that. You can find myself and Cam every week at Spyhards, where we basically tackle the best and worst of spy movies to figure out if they make the knock list, which is basically our list of the best spy films of all time. We've tackled things like GoldenEye, Bourne Identity. We have Tomorrow Never Dies coming out on Tuesday next week, so the day after this episode comes out. And you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Spyhards. That's SpyHards. S as in Shatner's death was better than Picard's.
And you can, of course, check out the episode on there on 3 Days of the Condor, which features Tyler.
It was, I think, your guys' best episode yet, if I'm just being honest.
Not according to the listeners.
Well, Scott, Thank you once again for joining us on Subspace Transmissions. Listeners, stay tuned. Cam and I will be right back with the Cam DeLorton Report.
Okay, Tyler, it's Mando time. It's the Cam DeLorton Report coming back with the latest episode of The Mandalorian Season 2, The Jedi.
Okay, I was a little down on last week's episode. I thought it was kind of derivative, a little too much focused on like nonstop action. This one, action-packed, mythology-heavy. For whatever reason, I dug it way more than I think any other episode so far in Season 2. What was your first initial take on this?
I love this episode. I always love when Star Wars really wears its influences on its sleeve, and you could just totally feel these samurai movie influences all over this one.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Like the moment where you had, the villain? I think it's Morgan Elsbeth, I think was the character's name, in her little garden there that Mando's going to visit. I'm like, oh, this is so perfect. It just feels like a samurai movie.
This Rosario Dawson character, blanking on her name, apparently she's a big deal amongst the animated fan community. I don't know if her look necessarily translates from animated form to live action. That headpiece looked pretty weird on her.
It did. Yeah, the character's name is Ahsoka Tano. And she's a very, very popular character. And it's interesting because I've kind of, within the span of my life, been able to kind of watch the evolution of the demand for a female Jedi character and then the franchise's response to it. So when you had the Star Wars novels that came out, you know, in the 90s, there was a character there called Mara Jade who came in. And female fans were so excited for this character. And there was a lot of cosplay for Mara Jade over the years. This character got a lot of, you know, a lot of use in the novels, comics, and all this. And then they created Ahsoka Tano for the animated Star Wars series. So it was actually canon usage of a character. And she's kind of taken the reins in a lot of ways up until we got to the sequel trilogy as the most, like, the big, big popular female Jedi character. And so I know people were ultra excited to see this character cross into live action. And I agree with you. The look didn't quite work visually. Like, I'm looking at kind of like the makeup and the headpiece, and it looks iffy. But what I really loved was it felt like a very specific character. Like, it felt like they really had nailed down who this character was right from their first moment, which, you know, like, I was totally down to see this character in future episodes.
We talked about the possibility of spinoffs last week. Do you think that's what they're trying to rev her up for in The Jedi?
I was wondering that, because when you hire Rosario Dawson, I mean, that's a pretty big name. So to have her just kind of pop into a couple episodes, maybe. But I do wonder if we are looking at potential spinoffs. And even if she isn't the star, of having her cross into multiple series or something, like, they could do that with a few of the characters now.
We already know that her mission is she's on the hunt for the deposed Grand Admiral Thrawn, who I'm not a big Star Wars buff, but even I've heard of that name. He's supposed to be kind of one of the most layered antagonists in the Star Wars universe. So it seems like that spinoff could have some potential.
Yeah, Grand Admiral Thrawn was created in the same novels that created Mara Jade, and he kind of took over the Empire after the Emperor and Vader were, you know, seemingly wiped out. And his whole shtick was he discovered like this lizard species that was impervious to the Force. And so it made him somewhat dangerous because Jedis couldn't get to him super easily. He's a character I know they brought into the canon animated shows, but those are set before this. And so I'm very, very excited to see what they do with this character. He's a blue-faced character. I believe he has like red eyes with kind of a black military cut. So I'm just fascinated to see what character actor they cast in this role.
What do you think of Grogu, the just revealed name of Baby Yoda? Will any fans actually refer to him as Grogu moving forward?
I like that they gave him a name. I thought the scene where, you know, she's training him was actually a really effective scene. But Grogu, the name, I don't know that it catches the same way the name Yoda does. I was wondering if they could have simplified it just a little bit more to make it more catchy.
Like Yeadle?
Or Yaddle was the female Yoda. Okay. Yeah. In Phantom Menace, yeah. I wouldn't have gone with like Yaddle. That was a little goofy. But I wonder if just like a very, very basic two-syllable word that doesn't have like the grow kind of sound in it.
Are you accusing Star Wars of having goofy names?
Never.
All right, so we only have two episodes left. I'm excited for where they go. We obviously need a little bit more, Moff Gideon. If we get a glimpse of Grand Admiral Thrawn, that would be cool. But we get a glimpse of, we presume it's Boba Fett wandering around on Tatooine. Would you be disappointed if we don't get that realized by the season finale?
I feel like they have to bring that back. Although, you know, as you said, like we're drawing to the end very soon. And I really do wonder how much of these threads are going to be paid off really by the end of the season, because we have Grand Moff Gideon with his dark troopers. We've got Boba Fett wandering around. We've got Ahsoka Tano still, seemingly potentially around on the show if they want to bring her back. It feels like a lot of elements to pay off in two episodes. So I really do think a lot of this is just going to carry over into the next season, the same way that, like, you know, Gideon was teased at the end of this first season.
Well, overall, we're enjoying Cam DeLorton more, I guess, than this episode of Star Trek Discovery.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I saw reviews from people who are fans of both franchises. And I saw more than a couple that said, like, Discovery, this is how you do, you know, canon elements into a brand new show. Like, do this, please. And I don't know if it's as simple as saying do this, because I just think they really seem to have it down to a science in the Mandalorian room. Like Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni really seem to have their finger on the pulse. It's kind of like these were just the two guys who understand this storytelling implicitly. You know, it's in their hearts for some reason. But I just I think other writers have to work harder to pull this sort of stuff off.
Yeah.
So I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Yeah, I guess we are up to episode 8 of Star Trek Discovery. So we are past the halfway point. It's going to be interesting to see what follows. So yeah, tune in and maybe we'll talk more about the burn.
Okay, you can of course find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in very concerned about the burn Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's Reportonn as in Navarre, as in Navarre want to hear about the burn again.
Nice. Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed and we're gonna let it burn.
Transfer complete.